Terry versus the Commonwealth. A chair and Mr. Jekyll.
The pressure's off.
Your writ is next.
Okay, you said the last case.
The last America's case.
Okay.
You're okay.
Give me a little startle.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Donald Jeffrey here on behalf of the Commonwealth. I guess I'll start out by saying I too believe I'm probably here checking a box because of the jurisdictional argument. I can't muster as interesting of facts as the last case.
You know, but you actually argue it should be transferred, that it shouldn't even be here.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And
is that because of Southerly?
It's because of Southerly, and as the court is aware, and I think this was developed on the briefs about as thoroughly as it could be by both parties. My opponent tried to make arguments based on Williams and Green. I have tried to address those on brief. I don't think I have a whole lot to add to that. I'll try to unpack
it. Can I ask you on Williams? Because he says that the Supreme Court says in Williams, distinguishes Southerly, because it comes a few months after Southerly, that it distinguishes Southerly essentially, this is what I'm gathering, is because in Southerly, the circuit court really never had jurisdiction properly in the first place, and that's different. That's a difference, and that we're not dealing with that here, and so Southerly doesn't really apply. And Williams would indicate otherwise, I guess.
Well, the difference in Williams, I think, and I'll admit that this, I mean, if we were just post-Southerly, I think this would be really clear. I think Williams perhaps muddies the waters a bit on this, but, you know, Williams was a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, and there is a specific statute on that, 19.2-296, contrary to the situation you have here. You know, the point that we made on brief, and I don't think there's anything post-Williams that's going to elucidate this anymore from the Supreme Court, but the point that we made on brief is, at most, that extends to a case where there would have been a specific criminal statute at play had the circuit court had jurisdiction to begin with. So there does seem to be some extension.
It's not a civil matter in which there's a motion to vacate the entire decision in the matter. Is that another way of saying it, or a different way of saying it, or a way you don't agree with?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well,
the
motion to vacate is a civil, purely civil matter, whereas the
as long
dealing
as it's
with the entire decision, whereas the motion to withdraw the guilty plea is part of the criminal matter.
It's part of the criminal process, and I'll read directly from Williams. Because a motion to withdraw a guilty plea under Code Section 19.2-296 is designed by statute, and I think that's the key point here, to be filed and disposed of while the circuit court retains jurisdiction over the case, the motion is criminal in nature. So, again, if you had a specific criminal statute at play, I think post-Williams, the argument would be stronger to retain jurisdiction here.
So theoretically, if there was some Virginia statute that the motion to vacate was based on that fell into the criminal context, then that would be okay. But in this instance, it's not.
I think that's where we are post-Williams, Your Honor. I mean, let me try to anticipate a question. Maybe it's not what you were going to ask. I mean, I think in theory, 801.428 has some bearing on these, but that's not really a statute of criminal procedure.
Right.
So
but it applies in criminal cases, and it applies consistently. And that becomes my question. Are we ruling incorrectly in all of those cases where the circuit court enters an order more than 21 days after a final order has been entered? Are all of those issues for us even to say that the circuit court didn't have jurisdiction because Rule 1.1 had divested it of jurisdiction? Are all of those issues something that under Southerly we should be transferring to the Supreme Court rather than addressing them ourselves? Because my minor case that came out a couple weeks ago, I addressed it, and maybe I shouldn't have.
I'm not sure I recall the facts.
You don't need to know. It is an 801.428. Correction of a Scrivener's error in the sentencing order.
Okay. I think where we are post-Southerly, all I can do is lay, I'd like to read mine, or I'll be happy to write something on that if it's imperative.
I don't think it's going to be necessary, but I'm trying to figure out what the outer limit of Southerly is, or is it literally, if there's not a specific statute And maybe 801-428 qualifies as a specific statute because the Supreme Court has clearly applied that to criminal cases in the past.
It has, and I think if you find that that is a criminal statute or criminal in nature, I think the case stays here. There is nothing applying an 801 statute from the Supreme Court of Virginia. If you think that makes it, I need to read the language again to make sure I'm not butchering the language. Designed by statute to be filed and disposed of while the circuit court retains. Well, now see, I think, Your Honor, that would be the distinction, and I don't want to.
Because the circuit court has jurisdiction to correct a Scrivener's error under 801-428, whether it's a similar criminal case, and so then you would look to the underlying case.
Scrivener's error.
And after Ballew, Scrivener's error has got a lot wider berth than one might think from just the language.
I'd have to think about that some more, but I think you're right. Clearly, you have jurisdiction to correct a Scrivener's error while you still retain jurisdiction under 1-1, but it's not pursuant to a specific. It's not pursuant to 801-428. That's just inherent in your criminal jurisdiction.
Well, right, but after 1-1, 801-428 would provide that you could go back and correct a Scrivener's error so long as the circuit court is changing the order to reflect what actually happened as opposed to what it had hoped, what it wished it had done to correct the error. And that applies to both, and the 801-428 applies both in civil and criminal cases, doesn't it?
It does. In fact, I think there may have been some effort to modify that, and it was not something that enacted. I believe there may have been legislation.
I think if Southerly was not out there, we wouldn't have any question about the jurisdiction.
No, because
but I think Southerly certainly puts it in unique set of context, meaning, okay, so the criminal case is over with, and what you're doing here is you're moving to vacate and the criminal case is done. So it's essentially the motion to vacate is viewed in as a civil issue.
Correct. And that's where we were post Southerly.
I mean, we can scratch our heads all we want, but that's what it says.
Yeah, and I'm not going to belabor the obvious.
And in fact, my question may be unfair to you. I don't mean to indicate any disagreement with you that Southerly, on your facts, dictates that result, but I have to be concerned about the next case as well.
Let me tell you where I think we are with the case law, and I think there have been some tacit assumptions made, and I'm guessing that my office didn't make that argument, if that was even a granted appeal that you just described.
It was, and you didn't.
We may have made the tacit assumption, but let me talk about where I think.
I will accept that it's right, because that means I was right.
Let me talk about where the case law has left us at this point, because I don't know that this court, it certainly wasn't argued by the other side, has ever addressed 801-428 specifically. You had Southerly, which I think Judge Decker just laid out perfectly where that left us. And subsequent to that, you had two appeals. You had one of which was essentially, look, jurisdiction over a suspended sentence, Green. That continues under 19.2306 in the criminal
Green
process.
Is not, yeah.
Green I don't think, really gets even close to answering the question that you asked. I guess where we're next left with is what happens post-Williams.
And Williams is rather brief. It says what you just quoted, and it doesn't really change any of the very broad language in Southerly, does it?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. And again, I'm reading the part that I bolded on pages 11 and 12 of my brief. Designed by statute to be filed and disposed of while the circuit court retains jurisdiction over the case, the motion is criminal in nature. I guess part of the reason I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage is I don't have 428 in front of me. But obviously the usual scenario is you're outside of 1-1 and something needs to be fixed. Is that language in that statute broad enough to encompass the clerical error that exists while the circuit court still has jurisdiction? Without looking at the statute, I hesitate to weigh in.
Well,
on that.
Correction of a clerical error could arguably be just administerial in nature and not have anything to do with either a criminal or civil conviction.
The scenario in Minor was that in the sentencing order, it was a plea agreement to 10 charges, and 10 charges with, different terms of years and suspensions related to all 10. And the sentencing, and everybody agreed, it was a written plea agreement, everybody knew he pled guilty to all 10. And for whatever reason, in the recitation of the charges he had pled guilty to in the sentencing order, they left one of them out.
Okay.
Now, fortunately, when they totaled the thing at the bottom, they put the right total, but of course it didn't add up because one of the charges was not included.
Okay.
And so then 60 days or 45 days, well
clear outside the jurisdiction.
Well out of 21 days, the court went back and entered under 428 and said there was a Scrivener's error, this was stated on the record, everyone agrees this is what happened. I have jurisdiction under 428 to correct the Scrivener's error and add it back in. And we basically, following that part of it along, would have said it was right. There was another more complicating issue about whether the circuit court had jurisdiction to consider a different motion. But that 428 does seem to allow that, that the court does always has jurisdiction to make its record reflect what actually happened as opposed to an error. But that seems to me to be consistent with Williams. It would allow a criminal court to correct that error, and that would come here rather than go up. But
and I don't think there's any sort of safe harbor for this fraud under 428.
I think it
certainly not under the Scrivener's error part.
No. I mean, it seems to me to be the merits would be interesting. The classic intrinsic extrinsic fraud issue and whether that makes it void avoidable and all of those good things, but I don't know that we need to get to the merits. I think you've covered the procedural issue very well.
I think what I can tell you, Judge Russell, is because I'm certain that when I started down this path that I researched the issue, I do not think that either court has expressly addressed the issue you asked about in a published or, I'm not sure, even an unpublished opinion, vis-a-vis Southerly. I think I'm pretty confident telling you that. So, you know, you're certainly, at least with respect to the question you've asked, I think you're on somewhat uncharted territory. Obviously, from what you've indicated to me, my office has at least made a tacit assumption that it is something that belongs here, though, in that context. I've got responses on the merits of this after having just told you that you shouldn't decide it. But it's very factual in nature. It's a clear and convincing standard, obviously. I've certainly, in the argument section, pretty succinctly addressed the claims that he makes and argue that the court was not plainly wrong in rejecting the fraud argument.
You may use all your time if you wish to, but I think you wrote a really, really good brief.
Thank you. I will rely on the brief unless the court has further questions.
We'll come down and counsel, which is so